The Capital Investment Committee hearing for March 11th is called to order. Members, we don't have a quorum, so we'll go straight into presentation of the governor's 2024 bond and recommendations for the Department of Public Safety, DEED, and Corrections. And then we'll also hear from DEED on their targeted community capital projects grant report, and also from the Office of Ombuds Correction for Infrastructure report. With that, welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety, and my honor to be here today. Thank you. Chair, members of the House Capital Investments Committee, thanks for having us here today to present our capital budget items. The first thing I would just like to show is a quick picture of the State Emergency Operations Center. Just an update on money that you have given us and provided for us in previous years for funding from this committee. Pictures on the slide show the new State Emergency Operations Center in Blaine. It's well on its way. As you can see, the walls are going up, and we expect the building to be completed in late May of 2025. Just a quick overview of what we're going to do today. We're going to bring forward the capital budget request and the governor's bonding bill for DPS. The governor and the lieutenant governor put forward a strong proposal to help address current issues and the future needs for public safety in Minnesota. DPS's law enforcement divisions serve every community in Minnesota, and building a new lab in Mankato will help evidence turnaround overall Minnesota. All of the projects here look to address public safety throughout the entire state. The projects are, number one, building a new Southern BCA regional office and laboratory. Number two, purchasing land for and designing an expansion of the BCA Bemidji regional office. And number three, purchasing land and designing a Minnesota State Patrol headquarters. And with that, to provide you more detail on each of these projects, I will turn to BCA Superintendent Drew Evans and Colonel Matt Langer to give you more details on those items.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I will go into a bit more detail, and we know we have a very tight timeline. So in all of your packets, you should have this, and I thank all of you ahead of time. I've met with a number of you on this project. If you don't, we will get it to you, but this is an overview of exactly what we're looking for at the BCA. As the commissioner noted, in the governor's bonding recommendations, it's $48 million to pay for construction costs for a southern regional laboratory in Mankato. Last year, you provided us with funding to enter into design services and authority to buy land. We have bought that land next to the Justice Center in Mankato, and the design is out for RFP right now, and we will enter into that contract very shortly to do that. The need that we're before you today for both the projects at the BCA really are designed because of the increased needs that we have currently and into the future for our laboratory. It really requires specialized space because of the examinations that we do in our facility that I will show you a couple pictures of in just a minute. And really, we've seen an increased trends across the state. One of the things in this packet, if you don't have, but I'll point it out just to show for you, is the increased trends into our labs. We've been remarkably accurate with predicting the increases in laboratory submissions over the years. Even in this one that you see before you, there's a green line that indicates the submissions of DNA into our laboratories. It looks like it's going down, but it is not. We had a significant spike in violent crime across Minnesota, and we're now back on the trends that we predicted. The criticality of this particular project, both for Mankato and moving forward with Bemidji, is that our headquarters location that does the bulk of our forensic science service and in Bemidji, the headquarters location was designed for 366 people. When we are finished hiring, we'll have 520 to 540 in that building. Last year, you provided us funding to build out the last remaining space at our headquarters facility. That will get us about 43 additional workstations. The Mankato project will get us about 50 additional and about 30 to 40 up in Bemidji as we go forward. In addition, the significant increase in digital multimedia evidence. When our headquarters location was formed, there was no such thing as digital evidence in terms of actual laboratories. We now have an accredited digital evidence laboratory. When I started at the BCA, it was one agent that did this part-time in their spare time for digital evidence. We now have 22 examiners full-time in a facility that was never designed to have that. Both these will have that going forward. I'm just going to show you come in the space. We have maxed out the space at the BCA. We have everybody in 6x6 cubes where we're able to across the space. We're just simply out of space to do that at this point in time. This is an example down in the, I think this will be on your left-hand side. On your left-hand side, it doesn't mean much to you, but it's a NIBIN station. This is the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, where we process firearms evidence from crime scenes. We've purchased additional machines to aid in investigations. That area was designed for one person, one machine. We have two in that location, and adding in two different locations across that. We have agents in some offices that were designed for one, for evidence handling, security, and three offices at this time. This is an example of what I did want to show you, the specialized space, which is unique to a laboratory. It requires specific space requirements. HVAC, the specialized air handling, we turn all of the air over in our facilities once an hour to make sure with all the chemicals that it's a safe environment for everyone to work. Also, in terms of the space that is needed for those, it has redundant power supply, coolers, freezers, etc., for all of our evidence that we need under our accredited system for our laboratory. We're seeking accreditation for all the facility, but for our lab in particular. The last thing I'll touch on briefly before turning it over to Colonel Langer is our Bemidji facility. So the first project would fund our construction costs. That project is as close to shovel ready as they come. In Bemidji, we have a facility we operate now. It's been great. It's been there for 20 years, but that facility is out of space as well. We have people that are in spaces designed to be conference rooms as their offices, etc. And so this would purchase a piece of land next door to the airport that would give us space to move forward. We would be able to expand on the current footprint right now, but we would not be able to expand in the future if we do that, and will create significant disruption to our operations during the construction phase. And so in the budget recommendations is designed for that facility so that we can expand that facility when funding becomes available, and to purchase a parcel of land so we'd have very little to any disruption in our activities, and into the future when we need additional space, it would create the space to be able to add on to that facility as well. And so with that, I will turn it over to Colonel Langer to go through the State Patrol, and then we'd be happy to answer questions at the end.
Welcome, Colonel. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Langer. I have the honor and privilege of serving as Chief of the State Patrol, and I have I'm pinch hitting actually for Lieutenant Colonel Christina Bogievich, who did this presentation last week in the Senate. I appreciate being able to visit with many of you over the past several weeks about the project that we have before you today. It's $22.5 million worth of bonding funds in order for this Minnesota State Patrol to both acquire the land necessary to build a headquarters, a comprehensive facility in the metropolitan area, and the design work that needs to go with that. It comes out of a pre-design report that the legislature funded a year ago that indicates that we need about 15 to 20 acres in order to do this. So currently the Minnesota State Patrol has six office locations that we have interest in combining into one location. Four of those are DOT facilities, two others are private leases. You can see by the stars where they are around the metropolitan area. So what this project isn't is building a new State Patrol headquarters. We have a headquarters in Town Square that would be absorbed into this facility. What this is actually building a comprehensive facility that ties together training, commercial vehicle, headquarters, East and West Metro. Our divisions that do all the work on the road in the East and West Metro would all be pulled together under one comprehensive facility that both has office space to do the work that needs to be done, the investigative space to be done, the evidence handling space that needs to happen, the conference room space for us to host the training that we have in the Metro rather than lease space elsewhere, and also the parking needs that are currently deficient both indoor and outdoor. So that is our State Patrol headquarters in Town Square. That's the outside of the building right now. It's leased space from a private tenant. The photograph that you see with the office setting with things, those are recruitment materials actually that are just strewn about because we don't have storage out of our training division in Shoreview or Arden Hills site. This photograph shows that's like the kitchen table. So like just like within a house, a kitchen table tends to be like the nerve center of everything that happens. Within both East and West Metro, there actually is a table, and that serves as lunch space. For the folks that work out of those offices, that also serves as sometimes evidence handling space, which is a problem when it comes to from an accreditation standpoint. It also serves as the space where we meet with victims of fatal crashes or the remaining family members of victims of fatal crashes to go over the case that their loved one was involved with. So everything that happens around that same table because there's no other space for us to do it within our East and West Metro facilities.
The evidence handling space shows just the confines with file cabinets and able to do the evidence handling in a way that we would like to as we move toward accreditation, especially as important. This table is the same table in the West Metro office. You see on the other photograph here, everything from brank chambers for commercial motor vehicles to defensive tactics pads and tools. So that's in our commercial vehicle site in Mendota Heights. As part of our pre-design report, we called out the vendor with the architectural vendor the need for additional commercial vehicle training space, including a bay to actually train people on a commercial vehicle instead of parts of a commercial vehicle. Evidence storage is a problem, both for many reasons that police departments understand. We just have a lot of evidence. All of it is sensitive. Obviously, the veracity of our storage is critical, and the storage veracity is very good. But the manner in which we move evidence and maintain evidence is tricky at best, mostly because we don't have the adequate space. We have safes within secure rooms because that secure room is not deemed safe enough as it is. So we have to have safes within that room because of the access issues and the physical strength of the environment that is around the area where we maintain that evidence. Garage storage space is always at a premium, both within our personal lives and professional lives. We have some of the sensitive equipment related to civil unrest response or the rapid response team, mobile response team efforts across the state of Minnesota that we oftentimes coincide with civil unrest, but it doesn't have to be. If you think Wadena tornadoes, you think St. Peter tornadoes, you think Red River flooding, some of those cases in our history in the state of Minnesota where we need a lot of people to go help as first responders. The trailer where a lot of that function happens from the State Patrol is parked currently between two buildings outside. Our evidence storage lots, our forfeited vehicle lots lack the storage, the security needs necessary to really meet the standard that we want to meet. Of course, the red circle here, as I draw people's attention to around that white car, that's a vehicle that's being stolen out of our forfeiture lot. So it's a vehicle being held for forfeiture, in our storage lot that is in the process of being stolen. That's a still frame out of security camera footage. These photos just highlight some of the space deficiencies that we have. Our six facilities were never built with public safety purpose. They were office space the DOT leased to us or private tenant space where we occupy. None of it was built for modern public safety purpose. You think employee security needs, you think evidence security needs, you think free and ample parking for the public to be able to interface with us to come pick up a copy of a report. Those are the things that we're certainly lacking in our headquarters office, in particular in St. Paul. So that's the long and the short of it. I hope there are some questions, but again, it's $22.5 million for land acquisition and design. One of the first questions that I always get is where do you want to build this? And I think the chair and others have asked that question, and the answer is we don't know yet. We have an area where we think it would be wise for us to be centrally located within the metropolitan area. There are parcels of property identified in the pre-design report, one of which is off the table because it recently sold, but we're working with the Department of Administration right now and have a meeting tomorrow actually to scour the metropolitan area again to find suitable properties so we can be ready should the legislature act on our request to make this reality. Mr. Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Colonel Langer. You know, if you're looking for space not too far from the metro area, we do have land between Litchfield and the Ball of Twine. Look at that. I'm you don't have to answer. But okay, so right now you have six different sites, and essentially you wish to combine them into one?
Representative Erdahl, correct. So of those six sites, two of them are operational areas where troopers come and go all day long. One of them is investigations, our crash reconstruction team, our drug narcotic detection team, and others. One of them is training, one of them is commercial vehicles, one of them is headquarters. And so the vision here is that we're actually pulling these sites together so that the State Patrol can completely reformat the operation in the metropolitan area. There is no other police department where the chief would say, I have a question of training, and then have to drive to Shoreview to meet with training staff, or for executive command staff to have a question related to commercial motor vehicle bills, of which come before the legislature once in a while, and there are three or four in the Senate on Wednesday, but our commercial vehicle people are not within headquarters. So The ability to tie together the entire operation in the metro to be more conducive for today's needs, let alone the future, is the vision of this project. So it's not replacing buildings, it's bringing everyone together under one comprehensive facility that we think will be able to allow us to provide superior service in the future.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Colonel Langer. It certainly appears to me that in terms of efficiency and cost savings, being together in one site makes a lot of sense. Hopefully as we go through this process, we can see if there's a way to do it.
Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it looks like the total ask is right about $75 million. Is that correct?
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grasso, that's the total Department of Public Safety ask for the two BCA requests and the State Patrol request.
Representative Grasso.
Might I suggest, Mr. Chair, that we take this project that's across the street, or no, just outside the doors here, and we could find $75 million real fast in there, cut back a few things, and we could put it where it belongs, in our public safety.
Members, any additional questions? So, Colonel Langer, just to before we move on to the next one, so you said that you're meeting with Department of Administration. So when could we expect you to find an actual location for us?
Mr. Chair, great question. So our meeting tomorrow is just anticipatory. We want to be ready, but we're in no position to find the land officially or to make a move on any property until we're successful with the bonding bill. So if we're in the bonding bill to the degree that we hope to be in the bonding bill, we'd be ready. In theory, we'd be ready to move as soon as those funds are available. So by July 1st, for sure, we'd be ready. But right now, we're not in a position to do anything official other than to continue to look so that we're ready should we be successful.
And then one question that I have asked of staff, I think from the DPS, is have you considered building next to the new operation centers, and why or why not?
Mr. Chair, another great question. So I know the commissioner led with the initial slide of the EOC that's currently under construction. That's a little bit outside of where we would prefer to be, but it's not outside the realm of possibility. So I'm happy to ask the Department of Administration to look at the area that surrounds the EOC and see if there's suitable property there that would fit within the needs of this design.
Okay. So seeing no other questions, thank you, Colonel, and thank you, Superintendent, for coming by today. Next on the agenda, we have Deed. Welcome to the committee, Deputy Commissioner. Please identify yourself and proceed. So while they figure that out, why don't we move the minutes. Representative Ryer, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 4th?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes for March 4th, 2024.
All right. Members, any discussion of approval of the minutes for March 4th? Hearing none, those in favor say aye. 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 As opposed to say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes March 4th is adopted. Representative Ryer, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 6th?
Mr. Chair, move the minutes for March 6, 2024.
Representative Ryer, move approval of the minutes for March 6. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye. 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 Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 6 is adopted. Welcome again, Deputy Commissioner. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kevin McKinnon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development at Deed. And happy to be here today to talk about our capital budget request that's in the governor's budget, as well as just a quick update on what happened last year, and also our targeted community capital grant program from a couple years ago that we'll give you an update on. So first, Deed's been extremely busy implementing some significant investments made last year. Over $1.8 billion came to the agency, and we have been extremely busy staffing up and contacting all the grantees, et cetera, and standing up new programs. And in an effort to continue to be efficient and certainly effective in managing these programs. That's a mix of both general fund and general obligation bonds. And on the next slide, I'll tell you, we did receive over $450 million last year in capital investment, both in GO bonds but also in general fund cash. What happened as it relates to our existing programs, we had three existing programs that were funded last year. Our Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Program was funded at $10 million. Our Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Program was funded at $1.5 million. Our Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program, $1.5 million. And then we had a new program called our Greater Minnesota Child Care Facilities that was funded at about $900,000. So all together, well over 100 provisions with about $450 million worth of funding. So as it relates to some of the individual special appropriations that we had 118 projects that we had to administer out of the two capital investment bills. We were very busy trying to schedule meetings and overview sessions for grantees. These programs for these communities went to a lot of different types of organizations. And given that there were a lot of new entrants sort of into this type of funding, we were worked very closely with Minnesota Management and Budget on process, on questions, and on implementation to help educate grantees. We've hired some staff. We have assigned all the projects out. All projects have a project manager. They've all been are working very closely to move their projects along. And to date, we've got 17 projects approved or awaiting a signature or two, and then 26 others that we hear from our grantees that will be ready to proceed in the next 3 months or less. So that's an update on last year's funding. As it relates to this year's capital budget request, we've got $5 million through two existing programs, our BDPI program. They are kind of long, so I'll try to use the acronyms here. The BDPI program at $3 million and our TEDI program at $2 million. So first, the Business Development Public Infrastructure Program. This is a program where we grant money to local units of government and only outside of the seven-county metro area. It covers 50% of the eligible cost to support an eligible business expansion. And you can see the types of infrastructure that it invests in, roads, water, wastewater, et cetera. Each community is only eligible for up to $2 million every 2 years, and it's really meant for industrial uses. So think manufacturing, warehousing, et cetera, all in an effort to help lower the cost of development on the end user and to help our communities prepare the sites. This program is available on a rolling basis, so as projects are ready and as cities are ready, they come to us with applications, and we are able to fund them with available resources that we do have. A good example of a project was in Laverne. We awarded almost $500,000 for a project that Lineage Logistics had in their industrial park. We extended some streets and utilities to the site. But you can see the type of project that it leveraged. It's a significant investment for Laverne, $50 million, 75 new jobs, a very, very large facility. Most of our, I shouldn't say most, all of our communities in Greater Minnesota are very familiar with this program and find it extremely useful. I'm sure you've all heard from them. Additionally, I just wanted to give you an update on where we are with the program balance. So last year we received $12 million, so $10 million in general obligation bond funding. We also have $2 million that we receive in a general fund appropriation. We currently have about $7 million left. And as I mentioned, we accept projects on a rolling basis. We have a couple that are in the pipeline to use a couple more million dollars. Our TEDI program, this is a joint effort between DEED and the Department of Transportation. This is done through an RFP process. We announce this once a year, essentially, usually in the fall. And we accept applications and make decisions on which projects that we will fund. This program takes care of some of the local investments that are needed for transportation improvements. There's a safety consideration with this, thus MnDOT is involved with us, but primarily what we're doing here is awarding based on economic development projects that happen in the region. We can fund land acquisition, pre-design, et cetera, for these types of projects that support the larger transportation needs of the community in order to better serve the businesses that are operating in industrial parks or other locations within the community. So a good example of this program is the City of Dayton. We provided $1 million to help with the Highway 101 interchange. This facilitated a more efficient and obviously safer transportation options for the businesses that are located in the in a business park that's nearby. You can see there's already a significant number of businesses in that location. And there's more room for more. So we were really excited about this project, and I know the people that live in that region are also very excited about it. As far as our balance goes, we have last year's appropriation and some rollover money, we had about $2 million. We will be awarding that here very soon to projects that are already in grant review. We also know that there's a couple of other projects that are in the pipeline that should this program be included, we'd be entertaining those proposals. And I wonder if, Mr. Chair, if there's any questions on any of this or the next part of this, I would turn over to our Government Relations Director, Ms. Dannon.
All right. So first off, we have Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. One of the questions I had was you hired staff. Are they permanent staff for working on these extra because so high? Are they permanent staff?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, currently they are permanent staff, and the reason is these are basically four-year projects. Mm-hmm. So this funding is available for 4 years. They typically take about that time to go through the process, so we'll have to reevaluate in 4 years. Yes.
All right. Representative Scraba. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, the city of the page on City of Laverne, how many applications are out there now for that? And go ahead.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, how many applications are out there right now for BDPI?
Yep.
Yeah, so we have two projects that we expect in very, very quickly, and we know that there are several others that now that we're getting to spring, other cities are also preparing for business expansion projects in their community.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner, I apologize. I want to thank you for working with the City of Dayton for a $1 million investment for $134 million. That's pretty good odds, really good odds, and I appreciate that. And I know I'm used to be the mayor of Ely, and we've done a lot of work with you folks, and you're right, Greater Minnesota knows what these are. I think everyone knows what they are. So when they are available, it makes a big difference. It helps a lot. So thank you.
Representative
Chair, that's it.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair and Deputy Commissioner. Just piggybacking off Greater Minnesota, we know we have got lots of unique challenges, and so I'm especially curious in the Greater Minnesota Public Infrastructure Grant Program and then also the child care facilities, if you could give us just a sampling of what types of funding that went to address needs, and then what kind of a geographic sampling did it cover?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll start with BDPI. BDPI is only available outside of the seven county metro area. And the types of projects that basically we're supporting communities with are industrial uses. So think warehousing, manufacturing, ag processing, et cetera. These funds are for public infrastructure, so the communities and the developer or who's ever developing the land are responsible to pay for the utilities that are going in. Oftentimes this can be very expensive for obviously small communities with very small tax bases. And so the state comes in with 50% of the funding to help with the cost of that. As it relates to the child care program, we have not yet rolled that out. That is public infrastructure funding, which basically means the child care centers will be publicly owned. We've just recently hired a director of our child care office. We actually have released our other program, which is the general fund program that's very similar. And so as we see more projects and as we see public projects, that funding would actually be available to those projects. Geographically, those can go anywhere in the state.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you so much for that. Appreciate it.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Deputy Commissioner McKinnon. Has the legislature dumped too much on you? I mean, were you able to get through all the requests that were made for you to work on the last session?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, admittedly, our agency was not necessarily prepared for the 10 times funding that we got in our budgets. However, we do feel like we're in a very good place right now. We have been able to not only continue with our existing programs, because many of our existing programs, like the ones before you today, are still in demand and we're still seeing that activity. But as far as rolling out new programs, we have added some staff. We've really been had some time to actually put them together and release them and get to a point now where we're actually administering the grants. And that's maybe a little bit more of where the challenge was. We didn't have the sort of back-end support to actually administer it, so the disbursements, the monitoring, et cetera, the reporting. And so now we are in a much better position than we were 6-8 months ago.
Representative Erdahl.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Deputy Commissioner. You know, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, frankly, I got numerous complaints about DEED in the last year. You know, maybe the legislature should do a better job of giving you the assistance you need if they're going to dump all this on you. I have a particular project in my district that is now 1 year in and nothing has happened because they couldn't get approval to do anything from DEED. I will say that as of this morning, I think we have reached an agreement that will allow this to start moving. So, and this was a new program, so I understand, you know, the difficulties in establishing this and basically trying to fit it into existing programs wasn't working because it was a new program. So, I'm glad to see or hear that you are making progress in this, but you know, don't be afraid to maybe ask if you think that too much is being given you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, any additional questions? Seeing none, just to that point, you know, Representative Erdahl, that's why we did put some general fund appropriations in the funding bills last session so that they could actually staff up and do the work. And I think, you know, you are highlighting a point where, you know, we are, you know, last session gave them a lot of work because it took us 3 years in order for us to get infrastructure package. And so if we could have a more regularly occurring bill, I think that that will, you know, relieve some of the pressure for all of our state agencies. So I really appreciate you highlighting that. Director, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Darielle Dannon, and I'm the Government Relations Director at DEED. I'm going to be walking you through the Targeted Community Capital Program report that we released somewhat recently at our agency. So this is a program that was funded in one of the 21 special sessions. So the legislature appropriated $24,000 for the Targeted Community Capital Project Grant Program. This program is available in statute, but this was a one-time appropriation for the program. There was a carve-out from the program of $6 million, which sort of in some ways set aside. But other than that, we, as an agency, we ran a competitive grant process. So we released one RFP. We received 101 applications from nonprofits for funding from this program. As you can see here, we are not allowed to award more than $1.5 million per organization. And then we ultimately funded 16 organizations with these funds. All the funds at this point has been appropriated, has been awarded out to organizations. You can see here from this little chart I put together that we've got about a number of projects that have been completed, a number of projects that are in process, and then there's a few projects that are still getting grant agreements together with us. And often that's because they need to do some fundraising on their own for to kind of have all the funding together so that we can move forward on the project. We've got about, I think it's just over $6 million that all the funding has been awarded, but we've got just over $6 million that we've expended essentially in this program. And I just wanted to share with you one story of impact. This one is about childcare. And we did a whole bunch of different things with these funds. But this program, and someone can correct me if I'm going to mispronounce this, but the Kutuska? Early child, thank you.
Kutaska.
There we go. Thank you. In Grand Rapids, Early Childhood Hub. So this was one of the organizations that we were able to award funding for. We're very excited. Our team's so excited. They were going to try to get you a video clip, but it was just too tricky here. But we're able to create essentially one-stop shop for both services to students, and then also their families. So really exciting opportunity to kind of do something creative in this area. And this is, again, in the Grand Rapids space. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any questions about the program or corrections to any of my pronunciations for others. I'm just joking.
Well, see, no questions. Thank you both, Deputy Commissioner and Director, for coming by before us. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we will move on to corrections. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, good afternoon, rather, Chair Lee and members of the committee. My name is Paul Schnell, the commissioner at the Department of Corrections. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the governor's bonding priorities for the Department of Corrections. With me today is Carl Hunt, the DOC's Capital Resource Administrator, who is here to provide some technical and process questions, and he's my phone-a-friend when it comes to the technical side. Before I speak to the request, I want to start by noting that this committee and members of this committee has toured our facility on different occasions, and we really are appreciative of that because it really helps people understand the scope and needs of our department and our staff and the people who reside in these facilities. I also want to extend our gratitude for including the DOC in the bonding bill last year. We are putting those asset preservation funds to very good use, and the project of expanding the rehabilitative space at the women's prison in Shakopee will be transformational to the women who are incarcerated there. Members, I'll start with a high-level overview of the DOC. The DOC is the third largest department in state government. The state prison system has a large footprint of the state, with 7.5 million square feet and 336 buildings within the department's 11 facilities. These buildings are where over 8,000 incarcerated individuals live 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. The mistakes of their past and our criminal code are why they are incarcerated there. It is the department's responsibility to then ensure that the individuals within our facilities are safe, healthy, and importantly, come out better than when they went in. These buildings are also the workplaces to over 4,000 dedicated state employees, who I'll speak more about shortly. Every prison across our state is different and unique, from security levels to age to infrastructure needs. Also of note, the DOC is heavily reliant on the general fund for all operations, as well as the capital investment process of this committee to function daily and to work toward our mission. Members, we take the mission of the department extremely seriously. That is to transform the lives of those we in our custody for a safer Minnesota. That work is critical because 95% of those who are incarcerated in our prisons will return to communities across our state. If it is our goal to make those who have been committed to our prisons come out better than when they went in, maintaining and growing our space to deliver transformative programming becomes essential. Turning to the two DOC bonding requests, you should have a one-page summary of our requests in your materials. For those of you who have had the opportunity to tour our facilities in the past, it should not be surprising that our first priority is asset preservation. The numbers on this slide speak for themselves. Of the deferred maintenance needs of all assets managed by state agency, 33% of the need, one full third, is within the Department of Corrections. The estimated cost of improving all DOC infrastructure to only fair condition is $723 million. Currently, the department has 16 buildings that are in crisis condition and 61 buildings in poor condition. As I'm sure you've heard many times in this committee, when maintenance is deferred, it only grows more expensive. Just 2 years ago, the estimate was $630 million. It has grown by $92 million over the past 2 years. Over time, we are edging ever closer to $1 billion in deferred maintenance for the Department of Corrections alone. This significant cost is due to the age and complexity of our facilities. Prisons encompass many aspects similar to an entire municipality, including health care clinics, water and sewage infrastructure, housing, grounds to maintain, classroom spaces, food services, and recreational spaces. They also include extensive and complex security systems that require ongoing maintenance for the safety and security of the facilities themselves. As I've mentioned, the context cannot be overlooked that these facilities are 24/7 living environments to over 8,000 souls. We must maintain spaces that are conducive to health, safety, and rehabilitation for their sake. However, I ask that you turn your attention to the roughly 4,000 individuals who work for the state of Minnesota in these facilities. Work in corrections is among the most challenging across our state enterprise, and the work is not without risk. There are correction officers, nurses, teachers, case managers, reentry staff, facility maintenance crews, and professionals who provide treatment ranging from sex offense treatment to substance use treatment who work within these facilities. We ask much of our staff, and on top of that, they face harassment and risk in the correctional environment that is very real. And the hours and stark separation from their loved ones can also be very difficult. And then there is the physical spaces in which they work. I understand that we're talking about prisons, but I ask myself how it would feel to work in these environments given the conditions of the buildings themselves. As an employer, we must be a more attractive place to work. In pay, and we made progress here, in culture, which is a work in progress, and in the environment, which is where our staff does their work on a 24/7 basis. jobs in corrections are very challenging by their nature. Each of the individual project requests that we make are designed to use our staff most efficiently. Unlike our current spaces, we want to create safer, more secure environments for everyone, the people who are housed there and the people who work there. Safety and wellness of state correctional staff must be a priority. Prioritizing their safety and wellness not only benefit our staff, but when our staff feel valued, it translates to improved services to the incarcerated. The significant deferred maintenance levels of the DOC are not just issues of crumbling walls and leaky roofs. They directly impact the safety of the facility. For instance, we have prison cell doors so old they must be manually secured by key, and in many cases, sight lines prevent safe observation of movement. The State Correctional Facility Security Audit Group has raised repeated infrastructure issues of concern for the safety of staff and incarcerated individuals. Often, our response to the audit group is concurrence with their filings and recommendations, but we almost always cite higher priority needs as the limitation to addressing their recommendations. Members, as you can see in this slide, examples of the need. We could have filled this entire presentation with similar examples from our 11 facilities. A significant challenge with this level of need is prioritizing projects. Just last fall, lead and other metal compounds were found in the drinking water at two of our facilities. We have since shifted priorities to address this critical issue. A few years ago, a large portion of bricks on the outside of a building at the Fairville prison fell off. We had to dedicate funds to repairing that and had to push other projects down the list. We will continue to meet those challenges and prioritize projects, but let me assure you, every bit of asset preservation funding you provide, the DOC, will be used to address the critical infrastructure needs of the agency. These photos do not tell the full story, so we made significant efforts to bring legislators into the state prisons. Over the past years, we've hosted 25 legislative tours, bringing in over 75 members of the House and Senate and over 55 members of staff inside the walls and razor wire to see the work and conditions firsthand. Moving now to the second portion of the department request, a critical expansion of rehabilitative space at the prison in Rush City. For reference, there is a separate handout in your material summarizing this project. Members, before I speak to this project and the need for the space, I want to address why, of all the previous bonding requests, did this one make it into the governor's bill? The need for this project is urgent. Since the prison was built 24 years ago, the state of Minnesota has not effectively managed and engaged the high-risk men incarcerated there at Rush City to improve public safety outcomes, to reduce recidivism, to reduce crime. Nor has enough been done to mitigate the intergenerational impacts of incarceration, as the men at Rush City are warehoused instead of being rehabilitated. We cannot risk continuing the impacts and past mistakes in prison design at this facility. We also cannot afford to receive only design funding in the bonding bill and risk a future legislature not moving the full project forward. We know how difficult this is politically, and it will not get easier down the road. Throughout my time as commissioner, it has become crystal clear that the severe lack of space at the Rush City prison has resulted in lost opportunities to improve outcomes. Let me explain. Members, when the Rush City prison was designed, the intention was for it to be single bunked. And even then, it was also intended to have more programming space than was eventually built. However, before it opened in 2000, the decision was made to double bunk the facility, meaning twice as many men were incarcerated in the prison than it was built for. This meant lack of space for rehabilitative programming created something of the worst practice in corrections, an idle population, which research tells us actually increases recidivism. Or a lack of programming is to be considered a criminogenic factor. Today, almost 1,000 men are incarcerated at Rush City, and a third of them are entirely idle. Many more have a minimum level of programming, but need much more. Not only are critical opportunities for our transformative and rehabilitative programming missed, like education, sex offense treatment, substance use disorder treatment, mental health programming, and job training, it also makes prison less safe for everyone who lives in it and works there. Rush City has the highest rate of idleness in the Department of Corrections. This prison should have been built differently, and I ask this committee to consider addressing this past wrong. And make no mistake, the prison in Rush City isn't going anywhere. An expansion will be used for decades to come, as this is the newest Department of Corrections facility. It is also one of three level four or maximum security prisons, and the other two are 100 years old. Moving on to the significant loss opportunities that this space presents and its impact on public safety. I'd like to explain the well-known and proven best practice in correction known as the risk principle. The risk principle is simple but central and effective corrections. That is, to create the most benefit, we must invest in those with the highest risk levels. Members, those who are incarcerated at Rush City have some of the highest risk levels in our system. Yet providing them rehabilitative services is critically limited. You can see here that over 200 men in Rush City do not have a high school equivalent. Providing this level of education is required of the DOC. Subsequently, we use up all the available classroom space so we can offer virtually no post-secondary education or vocational programming. And despite using all of our classroom space for GED service, the wait list for this program is still extensive. To reiterate, the DOC is not able to provide post-secondary or vocational education at Rush City, and the state has the opportunity to take advantage of federal Pell funding that is now available to incarcerated students. Men who are incarcerated there are virtually unable to obtain post-secondary credentials that would help them succeed upon reentry. Further, well over 50% of the population at the prison require behavioral health treatment, yet the facility has just two small rooms to accommodate appointments, sometimes requiring therapeutic staff to find corners in common areas for appointments with incarcerated individuals, which is entirely inappropriate for these kinds of services. Over 200 men are on wait lists for sex offender specific treatment programming. That is critical to reducing risk upon reentry. The only current space available for sex offender treatment at Rush City is a double wide trailer that with a temporary movable walls and the use of sound machines outside to ensure a level of privacy. I would also be remiss if I did not name that the prison has some of the worst racial disparities in the state's prison system, which is a sobering fact. We all know how incredibly stark disparities are in prisons. For instance, at Rush City, 55% of the incarcerated men there are Black and 7% are Native Americans. Members, in closing, I will say it again, 95% of those incarcerated in our prisons will return to communities across our state. We are all safer and healthier when those leaving our prisons do so successfully with the programming they need. And critically, their families are also better off. It is painfully clear how dramatic the impact of incarceration can have on the kids of incarcerated parents. And 73% of the prison population are parents. Their success creates better outcomes for their kids. Incarcerated parents getting a GED, better yet, post-secondary credentials makes their children more likely to be successful in education. thank you again for the opportunity to present the DOC's two requests. It is the nature of the work in corrections that is out of sight and too often out of mind for many in the public. Behind the brick walls and razor wire, the people who are incarcerated and those who work in our facilities are somewhat hidden. In the most basic sense, our prisons are where the failures of our society, the unaddressed traumas, the impossible challenges for our government are hidden. Whether it be the failures of our education and child welfare systems, mental health access, economic opportunity disparities, racist systems, our correction system is left to face and address these challenges and are expected to do so by producing better outcomes. We are not ignorant of the political realities on both sides, of investing in prisons and the difficulty that that brings. But outcomes of incarceration matter, as do the well-being of our staff, the incarcerated population, and their families. With that, Mr. Chair and members, we can stand for any question you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any questions? Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We toured Rush City, correct? That was the one we did. Fantastic tour. Appreciate the coin. That was good, too. One of the questions I have is the trailer that the training was going on, is that going to go away? Is that part of the plan here so that you don't have to take them in and out of, and it all goes into one? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative Scraba, yes, that trailer would be gone and that would be all connected, which would make movement much safer and far better off and built for specific use.
Representative Scraba.
That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for coming. I just have a question regarding one example, your ADA entrance ramp that's crumbling apart. Don't you have a temporary budget or a repair budget or anything like that to correct that? Is it still that way now?
Commissioner.
Chair, Representative, I'm going to turn here to Carl Hunt, who would probably be better able to address the specifics of that.
Welcome, Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Carl Hunt, DOC Capital Asset Administrator. Yes, we do have prior year asset preservation funds, which we have in process to address a lot of these projects. The need is large. So our prior year asset preservation funds have been allotted and queued up to many other projects. So that list continues on to grow, and we do address those as needed.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. So has that ramp been fixed then?
That ramp is in use the way it is today. It's usable. It's in dire need of repairs.
Representative Carroll.
So it hasn't been fixed?
Director.
Mr. Lee, it has not been fixed in total.
Representative Carroll.
All right. Thank you, Chair. That's all I need to know.
Representative Koslowski.
Thank you, Chair. And Commissioner, last year the legislature, I believe, granted funding for pay increases to help with recruitment and retention. Can you talk about what kind of effect that's had in terms of increasing and making sure that there's safe working conditions and adequate staffing in the corrections facilities?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. The good news is we have seen a dramatic turnaround. Right now we are at 87% vacancy full rate, so we are at 13% vacancy. With a new academy that is going to start next week, we will be at 95%. We have 100 new COOs starting just next week. So the new contract has really turned around, and we believe we are on the road to addressing this backlog. And so that is one of the huge considerations and was a major concern for us. But these environmental factors do remain an ongoing issue from the standpoint of work engagement for our workforce.
Representative Kalowski.
Great. And two more, one comment and a question. Thank you, Chair and Commissioner. In terms of for the culturally affirming services, given the
overwhelmingly large representation of Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks, which as a legislature, one of the things that we need to continue to tackle is the on-ramp from the foster care system. We know that's a very big predictor into, but when folks are incarcerated, I'm hearing from community members that are being asked to volunteer and to provide those services. And so my recommendation would be that our communities are already being tapped and expended and to drive and to go and provide that for free, offering stipends or building that into the workforce. And my second question is, in terms of the facility and looking for either rehabbing or building new, 25% of Minnesota's youth identify as outside of the gender binary, and I know that the policy right now is that if you are gender expansive, you can, you know, be moved to a facility that matches, but that's not the case for the population that we are continuing and we're going to see going into the future. So can you talk about how you will ensure that we'll have gender inclusive facilities if the state invests in these dollars and ongoing? Thank you.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kozlowski, yes, I mean, I think we have right now one of the, I think one of the most responsive and reflective policies in the nation as it relates to the transgender population as a whole. That does not mean that we don't have work to do to make sure that we have safe environments for people to go that are reflective of their identity. And that is really, I think, a critical requirement, whether it's issues of racial identity, sexual identity, ethnic identity, and these are all things that we need to be, I think, concerned about as we look at how it is that we respond to and address people's needs, because that directly relates to their success as they transition back into the community. So I will tell you that all of the programming look that we are doing focuses on providing culturally relevant services to whomever it is that we serve.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. I didn't hear in there a response to the facility plans, but look forward to having those continued conversations ongoing. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Director, for coming before us. So next on the agenda, we have the Office of Ombuds for Corrections Infrastructure Report. Welcome back to the Minnesota House. As this person, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Ombudsperson Margaret Zadra. Did that get into the mic? Okay. Out of here. Thank you so much for having me here this afternoon. I appreciate the time. As you know, the Office of the Ombuds for Corrections is separate and independent from the Department of Corrections, and our role is to investigate complaints from incarcerated people, staff, and community members, as well as investigate systemic concerns. We can facilitate resolutions, make recommendations, and publish reports, as well as provide education and information to help people navigate the system. Our statutory mission is to promote the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. We really focus on issues related to equity and health and safety. So our priorities in addressing both individual and systemic issues that advance equity and provide for greater accountability and greater transparency, in addressing those inequitable systems within and outside of corrections. So that segues to our report. I think all of you have a paper copy of it in your packet. But Minnesota prisons, no news, have been under-resourced for decades, are crumbling. Within our report, we identify that as a state, we must develop a strategy to dedicate resources to upgrade and maintain facilities, as well as replace facilities that are unsafe and cannot be adequately rehabilitated. You're probably familiar with the 2020 OLA report that really looked at a comprehensive view of safety in state correctional facilities. Within that, there was a chapter specifically about infrastructure. And the key recommendation in that report included the necessity for a strategy and funding to address the infrastructure and safety needs in Minnesota prisons. In particular, the report highlighted the two highest needs facilities, which are St. Cloud and Stillwater. They are both over 100 years old. And, you know, as you see here, some pictures of Stillwater, you can see a picture from 1908. That was actually before the facility was moved to its current location. The very, very first iteration of Stillwater was actually built before Minnesota was a state. When it was moved to the current location in 1914, it was built, as you can see with the picture in 1950, but still very similar structure. If you walk into Stillwater today, which I think a lot of you were able to join tours, you can see that it looks the same. We have not updated in those high-tiered open-faced cells or what you would also see at St. Cloud. The problem with that, of course, is that those design features are outdated, and it really increases the danger for incarcerated people and staff. I think it's important to note that there's some been really important investments over the years from bonding in particular to both of those facilities, and there's areas in the facilities that have absolutely been updated, and those are important investments. And we don't want to negate that work, but there's many, many needs that are unmet, and that price tag keeps going up. A 2014 study for replacing St. Cloud came with a price tag of $400 million. Due to inflation, that would now likely be as high as $1 billion. So continuing to delay addressing these needs continues to increase their cost. It's not just St. Cloud and Stillwater, of course, that have challenges. All 11 DOC state prison facilities have significant infrastructure needs. And we've heard from many staff about the ways that they're addressing this. And I give a lot of credit for the creativity and the MacGyver level skills that staff have incorporated to keep things moving. However, that's not a sustainable or effective path towards the future. In all 11 facilities, it's not just that there's things falling apart, it's that they pose real significant safety challenges. Even the newer facilities have significant concerns, including loose and falling bricks or other parts of the building that have fallen that can either cause harm or be weaponized. Staff's resources are often directed towards mitigating, for example, standing water, rather than attending to some of their primary programming or security needs. And in every facility, there's sightline concerns. We know that this causes real significant harm. That decades of under-resourcing, as the commissioner pointed out, has led to a deferred maintenance cost of $720 million. I know this is a really challenging conversation, but we want to really be elevating what is the cost benefit here. Is there a benefit to continue to investing significant state resources into failing structures that do not best serve public safety needs? We do need to continue to house people, provide programming in these facilities. So some investments have to be made, but is that investment better made there, or is it important to be evaluating the cost of investing in new facilities? You can tell I say investigating very, very often. We're also seeing with this not just, degradation that is unsightly or uncomfortable. This takes a real toll on staff, incarcerated people, and also in general public safety in Minnesota. We cannot pretend that what happens within our prisons does not affect what happens in our communities. Unaddressed infrastructure needs leads to unsafe conditions for staff. Full stop. It just does. staffing challenges. It is much, much harder to staff the facilities that are older and have poor sight lines. There's a lot of forced overtime at those facilities, which also leads to other safety challenges. And more staff are needed to monitor those facilities. It leads to significant levels increased stress for staff, which also leads to retention issues. So even when those new hires are happening, which is fantastic, it is a challenge to retain those staff. It also leads to significant issues for incarcerated person safety. There are increased violent episodes in these facilities. There's increased stress and trauma for incarcerated people, and of course, decrease in programming and opportunities for success, which we heard about a little bit for Rush City. With that comes unaddressed health needs. Across the nation, we are seeing a significant growing need of the population of incarcerated people, and we're seeing that in Minnesota as well. If you did not see the article today in NPR, I highly suggest checking it out. It talks a little bit about the aging need of population across the nation, but also here in Minnesota. People that are behind bars tend to age faster than people in community. So over 50 could be considered elderly in a lot of ways within facilities. And Minnesota has more than 1,400 people over the age of 50 that are incarcerated in our prisons. And we just do not have the physical plant structure set up to address these needs. And it's not just aging. We're seeing a higher level of chronic illness, mental health concerns, substance use disorders, and other disabilities. A long-term strategy is critical, as antiquated prison facilities are not equipped to house and provide the high level of care that is increasingly in demand. I will also highlight that health care is a constitutionally protected service that needs to be provided to incarcerated people. Despite significant efforts of staff and incarcerated people, again, I really want to highlight how dedicated staff are and how creative they are. This is an incredibly difficult situation, and these decades of under-resourcing has led to a public safety crisis. Our office has provided several recommendations in order to prioritize significant resources to meet the safety and security needs that preserve health and human dignity. First of which is population reduction. I think we actually, I don't know what I'm bumping here. I apologize, I'm gonna go right back. I think I may be hitting the mouse. In particular, population reduction, we can invest significantly in looking at that, particularly for people that pose little public safety risk. Many of the elderly people, aging population, are posing little public safety risk. I do also want to note, you know, as a state, we do this pretty well. Neighboring Wisconsin, they have a prison population of about 22,000 with a similar sized population of the state. And we have about, you know, 8,000. So we do this, but we have some really long sentences that are significant, and that also leads to that aging population risk. The second piece is really a comprehensive infrastructure plan. So targeted funding that would provide for a comprehensive review and long-term corrections planning. We recommend that there's a consideration for a legislative task force to direct any plan or study and include all the DOC facilities and not just the two highest need facilities. I think one of the challenges we've heard from legislators is that it's just really hard to see the complete scope of the problem. And we understand why the DOC often brings their top priorities, but when we're looking at these couple of pictures, when we're talking about things like the crumbling ramp, this is such a small percentage of it, and to see it in totality is really, really concerning. And it's also the only way we can really look at the total need in front of us. And so we really highly recommend that anything that we're looking at, that we're including the need comprehensively. With that, we can address security, safety, and programming needs and build those into a full scope, multi-phase, long-term infrastructure plan. Every time I'm bumping ahead. For those who must remain incarcerated and for the many dedicated staff who report to work in under less than desirable conditions. Maintaining, upgrading, and investing in new facilities where necessary is critical to ensure the health and safety of staff and incarcerated people. And I think I was excited to get to questions, and so finally there. So, any?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully I can match your level of excitement. One of the comments early was that one of the things you deal with are the complaints of incarcerated people. What's the most common complaint?
I'm this person.
Chair and Representative, the most common complaint we receive is related to medical, so health services, lack of, you know, options perhaps, or maybe the length of time to get an appointment, and we, under that umbrella includes mental health care and dental care.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So you were saying mental health and physical health, they're both. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Members, any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you so very much for bringing this report forward for us to consider. With that, members, here's just the roadmap for the next few hearings. So on Wednesday, we'll be taking action on two bills, House File 3631, which is the modifications bill, and then House File 4763, which is a date change for a required report. And so the intention here, we'll just move it as a vehicle to Ways and Means. And then we'll also continue to hear from the governor's recommendations from the Public Facilities Authority, Department of Health, the Pollution Control Agency, and the Minnesota Historical Society. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.